Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. I am Ikrashi Gupta-Chima, your host for the New Books Network. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Michael Hirschfeld to talk about his book, Subversive Archaism, Troubling Traditionalists and the Politics of National Heritage, published by Duke University Press in January 2022. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Hirschfeld.
My pleasure.
Could you introduce yourself to those in our audience who don't know you already?
Well, I'm a social anthropologist. I grew up in Britain. My background was that of a refugee family. So I think I was always exposed to a lot of cultural differences right from the start. And my parents also enjoyed traveling overseas. I became very interested in Greece, partly as a result of a school trip. And eventually, after not doing very well, I must say, as an undergraduate in archaeology at Cambridge, I went to Greece on a scholarship that allowed me to find my way to social anthropology, which I'd already actually begun to suspect for a while was much more suited to my temperament than archaeology. I'm frankly more interested in, even if I do deal with material things, in approaching them through people. And the other thing that perhaps might interest your audience is that although I set out as a specialist in modern Greece, I've actually done field work in both Italy and perhaps more surprisingly in Thailand, and that's part of the story behind this book.
Yes, I was very curious about that, like how you're working in, you know, like these very different locations that but at the same time, like these events, I feel like are taking place in a lot of communities. So it makes sense that you would draw these connections. So tell us a little bit about the genesis of this book.
Well, in a way, your last comment, I think, points in the right direction. Part of my training, I did my doctorate at Oxford, and part of our training emphasized the importance of comparison. There's, of course, been a lot of criticism of the comparative method, particularly because it has associations with colonial rule. So even though I think that's not a necessary connection, it's one that we have to take very seriously. I am not particularly in favor of what people like to call controlled comparisons. My goal is to make outrageous comparisons and then show why they're not outrageous. I think that's much more interesting. It provokes a lot more in the way of new thinking. I had never intended to do fieldwork in Thailand. I went to Thailand at the age of about 50 with the intention of meeting one of my oldest friends who happens to be Thai. Through him, I got to meet some members of the local intellectual community, including one or two really interesting anthropologists, and came back to Cambridge now, Cambridge, Massachusetts, of course. I've been at Harvard since 1991, with the idea that, yes, this is a place that interests me. And I was very curious about why it seemed oddly familiar, even though it was very different from any other country I'd visited. In the end, I came to two conclusions about that, both of which I think are relevant to this discussion. The first has to do with my own background. There were quite a few Thai boys at the school that I went to in London. And I think there was something just very familiar about the interactions that made me feel suddenly at home in a very curious way. But the other was the sense that Thais had a certain attitude to European outsiders that was not unlike that of Greeks. This also generated another concept that comes into play in the book and is the subject of the book I'm now working on, namely crypto-colonialism. In other words, seeing how much further the poison of colonialism spread than simply those patches so marked on the globe. So that was the beginning. And then I decided that since I'd been working on the clash between state governments and or national governments and local people over questions of historical memory and especially heritage, it would be a good idea to try to do something similar in the Thai context that would be immediately comparable to what I'd done in both Greece and Italy. In Italy, I actually worked in Rome, and so working in another capital city also provided another basis of comparison. Both of the places I worked in Rome and Bangkok, respectively, are in symbolically overloaded places within the national capitals. And this, I think, really focused my mind on some of the topics that have now emerged in this book.
Yes, definitely. When I started reading the book, you know, like I instantly was like, oh, this sounds so familiar. And, you know, like this is happening like in this place or that place. And then like, as I got more into the book, like I was very impressed with the variety of examples that you draw from around the globe. So tell us, what is subversive archaism and who are subversive archaists?
Well, I tried to define it in the book as the seeking for an older form of social organization, political organization, as a means of pushing back against the nation state, or what I call the ethno-national state, which I think is actually a better description for what most states have become, even if they weren't intended that way in the first place. The nation state is, as among others, part of Chatterjee has pointed out, but I pointed out in a very different way, I think, in this book. It's a very new invention. I mean, it really only appears in its present form at the end of the 18th century. And by now, it's become common sense. Well, everybody since Gramsci has recognized that common sense is a form of hegemony. It's really the way in which we are led, without thinking very often, to accept as inevitable a certain form of consociation. What the subversive archaists do is recognize that although they have a deep affection for much of what we would call their heritage or their traditions, and they share that affection with the nation state, they don't think the nation state does a very good job of preserving it. They even recognize that the precursor of the nation state may have been an ethnically much more complex mix than the ethno-national logic would have us believe. So basically, they're subversive because they're saying, look, guys, we know better than you do how to manage tradition. You are essentially neocolonial lackeys. That's where the crypto-colonialism also comes in. You're doing things that look very Western, that look very Anglo-French, if you will, or German. They don't really have very much to do with our understanding of heritage. And so why are you telling us not to behave in ways that we consider legitimate? Now, this is not to say that the state couldn't argue back, but you live within a nation state and you have broken its laws. And that's where, of course, the conflicts arise.
Yes, thank you for explaining that. So in the book, you discuss three quite complex facets of the images and symbols that subversive archaists mimic or mock, and which are simultaneously local, national, and global. Could you elaborate these facets and how subversive archaists use them?
You've pinpointed something quite important here, I think, which is the scalar nature of the argument. I began working, I think every anthropologist nowadays does work in this way, implicitly at least, every time you do a field project in a specific location, it is also contained within, or sometimes tries to spill outside, at something like a nation state. But I began to focus on this much more explicitly in a 2004 book called The Body Impolitic, which of course was intended as a pun, in which I was looking at the bodies of artisans as sites of hegemony, of domination, of unequal relationships between artisans and their apprentices, and the learning not only of craft, but also of certain behaviors that paralleled similar ideas, first of all, about the particular location in relationship to the capital city or the major cities of the country, but then of the country itself in terms of its relationship with the European Union and more and even broader geopolitical entities. So this kind of leaping among levels on a scalar frame seems to me now to be perhaps one of the most useful things that anthropology as a discipline can contribute to political analysis. That's certainly been my hope. And I think that these subversive archaists understand their principle very well. They know that while they're talking very locally, they are also speaking to perhaps numerous levels. Let me give you another example, not from my own work, but from something that I mentioned in the book, Fiona Greenland's work on the tomb robbers in Italy. They are often very local. They're local heroes. But their heroic status is also understood at the national level, because against the national bureaucratic discourse, they are arguing that as they fossick around in the soil, they are actually quite literally closer to the true soil of the country. And they play with a metaphor of connection to the soil that is, of course, very deeply rooted in many nationalisms around the world, but particularly, I think, in the kind of European right-wing nationalist logic. And they do it very successfully, because in that way they've been able to fend off the kind of opprobrium that official Italy would like to heap on their heads.
Yes. How do you compare metaphors of family kinships with national kinships, and what is their relationship with spatiality of power?
Well, national kinships are metaphors, right? I mean, every country seems to set itself up in some way as the mother and father of the people. There are some more elaborate versions of this. For example, in Turkey, Carol Delaney has written very interestingly about this, among others. Where you see that this is a very explicit exploitation of the dominant local idiom of kinship to represent the whole country as a family. Kinship is spatial in the sense that although it isn't the same thing as locality, it's often very closely related to residence through inheritance. And that nexus of kinship, inheritance, and space is what gives us the logic of the relationship between heritage and the nation state. Richard Handler was arguing many years ago that the idea of the nation state was grounded in, as he points out, what C.B. Macpherson called possessive individualism, the emergence in early modern Europe of the idea that to be a full person, you had to own property. And that this was not just about the ownership of territory, it was about having a culture, as Handler rather nicely puts it. I think that argument is still very compelling. It certainly explains the extraordinary resemblance among national museums around the world. I remember once going into a museum in Korea and falling into conversation with a bunch of Thai teachers who were looking at the exhibit, and they were obviously somewhat bemused. And I pointed out to them, I said, this does look familiar, doesn't it? And I think they immediately, you know, recognized that. Of course, those kinship modalities can also be massaged into even clearer recognition in terms of local languages and local ideas about the ideal sorts of kinship. And they're also sometimes interesting confusions or intentional confusions. For example, in China, the word for a country or a nation, if you will, includes the element jia, which also means patriline and family, nuclear family and home. So similarly, in Crete, where I was working, rather cleverly, the villagers would confuse, and I say cleverly because I think it was not entirely unintentional, they would confuse the idea of the patrilineal clan with the idea of the nuclear family by calling them both oikogenia. Now, oikogenia is the standard modern Greek word for family, but it contains the element genia, which actually means patrilineal clan. So it's important also to look at what happens in language. And there you see this alchemy through which kinship links of various kinds at the local level are manipulated by managers of national discourses to create a sense of loyalty and belonging.
Nice. I particularly found your alternative reframing of the concept of religion in conversations about the nation state and the subversive archaism very compelling. So what makes this reframing of religion as cosmology more effective for this discussion?
Thank you for that question. I have long felt that the term religion, but it was certainly an improvement on superstition, for example, but it tended to isolate religion as something inferior to science. Now, we may believe that religion offers inferior explanations to science. I'm sure some people do. If we take an anthropological perspective on this, I would argue that this is A, very Eurocentric. It's actually simply reproducing the Enlightenment hierarchy. And at the same time, I think it somehow demotes a form of knowledge about the things that we simply cannot know directly. That's what both religion and science often deal with. So just as we could talk about physics as a form of cosmology or geography as a form of cosmology, let's talk about religion as a cosmology. It's an explanation of how the world, cosmos in Greek, actually works. It also is a way of talking about people, because cosmos in modern Greek just doesn't just mean the world, it also means people. So we, even when we talk about gossip, we'll say, you know, that's what, or cosmos says, meaning that's what people are gossiping about. I think that this move is important because it allows us to think of religion as one of a whole series of ways in which human beings try to come to terms with the fact they can't read each other's minds. They don't really know how nature works. They don't really understand what lies beyond our immediate perception of the physical world we live in. I tend to believe what most scientists tell me about the universe as they understand it, because this is the best bet I have available to me. I tend to think that some religious specialists can give me very good advice about ethics, not all of them, of course, and we might argue one way and another about that. And it also depends on particular individuals you're talking to. But this is my point, that religion shouldn't be treated as a thing apart that then is liable to be dismissed as unimportant. After all, whole wars are being fought even as we speak in the name of religion. There's a great deal of intolerance that is practiced in the name of religion. It's not all good things, and cosmology is not necessarily morally acceptable in all its forms. In fact, it very often isn't. But by treating religion as cosmology, we're showing it the same respect that we show to other forms of knowledge. And to me, that is important.
Yeah, that's very fascinating. In the book, you also talk about the concept of a polity and the localization of that concept in the areas where you are working. So could you speak a little bit about that?
Sure. It's actually quite central. You know, when I first conceived of this book, it was in response to the invitation from the University of Rochester Anthropology Department to give the Morgan Lectures, and that was the basis of the book. And I first published the main lecture under the title under which it was originally given, What is a Polity? Because it seems to me that there's a constellation of words that we use, polity, but also civility, for example, that has to do with some sense of the relationship between a conceptual and also often spatial organization of society with ideals of appropriate behavior, the ideals of essentially the behavior that makes social life possible. Now, people have often used polity in the past simply to think about those that are now available to us, which for the most part means nation states. I'm trying to resuscitate it here as a way of saying, wait a minute, the nation state is a Johnny-come-lately, and actually there are many other kinds of polity, and these subversive archaists, consciously or otherwise, and I wouldn't presume to know how far they're conscious of what they're doing, have latched on to the spectral traces, if you will, of those polities and have brought them into the foreground for their own purposes. And again, the examples of Greece and Thailand are directly comparable, shocking though that may seem, because Greece, after all, is associated with the idea of the polis, which is the term from which we get the word polity, and also politics, but also police, we shouldn't forget. It's not all good, as I say. And in the case of Pomahakan, in the case of Bangkok, we're looking at people who consciously or otherwise are resurrecting a notion of the projection of the divine order, again, a cosmological concept, the mandala, onto a territory. And it's a projection that doesn't look like a modern nation state, in part because it's very flexible. Its outer edges contract and expand according to the nature of the power at the center. It's a very widespread concept all through Southeast Asia. I saw it in that small community of Pomahakan in Bangkok, where I was doing research, when, for example, there was a meeting of the whole community, and I suddenly saw that people were sitting in a more than a semicircle. It was sort of a three-quarters circle, with the president standing essentially where you would expect the king to be enthroned and telling the community what he thought ought to be done. The older men were seated and high up. They were seated on tables at the back. The women tended to sit a little bit lower down, but still at the back if they were of a certain age. In the front, you had the young people, especially young women, who'd taken their shoes off as a sign of respect so that they would sit on a carpet that was put right in front of the president. And they were quite vocal, so that by accepting their relatively humble position in the structure, they were also claiming the right to speak as representatives of that position. Now, this is not what people in the West understand as a democratic system, but it certainly is a system that allowed them a great deal of voice. And it seemed to me physically quite clearly to reproduce that mandala-shaped structure, with some coming and going, some expansion and contraction and so forth. I would be surprised if anyone in the community actually thought of it that way. But the mandala has always been a very influential form throughout the area, actually also beyond Southeast Asia. John Gray, for example, has written about how in the Chetri community he studied in Nepal, the mandala is understood to be the basis of the form of people's houses. And we shouldn't forget again, since we've been talking earlier about scale, that you can go from the house to the community to the larger entity, the larger polity, and see parallels among them all the time. So the idea that somehow this meeting would reproduce something that was larger than the community itself harmonized very nicely with the leaders' constant reiteration of the idea that they were just a small piece of a much larger situation. So I think that the concept of polity was very useful to me in teasing out these rather ghostly spectral presences. I'm now getting more and more interested in the idea of spectrality as something that actually haunts the nation state, not in some some sci-fi sense or some ghost, some mystery writer sense, but more it haunts them simply as a source of danger to the idea of the control of the nation state. Arjun Upadhyay has written, for example, about spectral housing in Mumbai, and in a way, that's another example of the same sort of thing. I see a lot of this kind of thing in the work that Mariela Basagalupo has done with Mapuche shamans in Latin America, looking at how, again, they conjure up some sort of imagery that is cosmological in the sense that it is related to an understanding of a world that goes far beyond the immediately knowable universe of where you live.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Fascinating. This book has so much current, very urgent, very relevant conversation like going on, and you know, so diverse at the same time too. And other thing that you talk about in the book is that you didn't observe any hostility towards immigrants among communities like Pau Mahakan or Zaniana, despite this hostility in more urban communities. Then you also talk about like a sharper class divide surfacing in these communities. And you draw example from like a wide array of locations, cultures, and communities. And you then caution against assuming that all subversive archaics archaize in the same way. So how do you compare these different archaisms and the shifts within archaes and their communities?
Well, a number of people have pointed out to me that some of these people have in the past, or some people with very similar tendencies have turned out to be fringe fascists or fringe anarchists or whatever. And I'm sure that does happen because there are always opportunities when people feel that they are oppressed for those who perhaps are a little bit more inclined to violence to act in this way. I should remind you that Pom Mahakan is an urban, not a rural community. It's right in the middle of Bangkok. It's in the old city of Bangkok. It looks like a rural community, and you can actually find similar sorts of arrangements in large cities elsewhere. But what's interesting is they're all being destroyed in the name of trying to have a centrally controlled city form. So, for example, in Rome, when I first did research there, the place where I was working was very much like a rural village. Everybody seemed to know everyone else. Within a week, I seemed to know a lot of people I met on the street. That's all gone now through gentrification. That was not directly the result of a government policy, but it was certainly produced in part by government complicity with developers who were gentrifying the area for profit. So it's hard to generalize, and I don't actually think anthropologists are in the business of generalizing. That's partly why we're not very popular with other social sciences who like to be able to, or claimed that they can generalize. But by setting up this model, I'm also suggesting that you could look at a number of uses of heritage and then decide on the basis of each one empirically whether it conforms to this pattern. I found it remarkable that both in Pomahakan and in Zonyana, there was an extraordinary degree of openness to outsiders. When the tsunami hit Thailand in 2004, the people of Pomahakan held an auction to raise money to send two volunteers down to help. The president said, "We don't care whether these people are Muslims," which they mostly were, or Buddhists or Christians or whatever, or whether they're foreign or Thai. The point is that we, as a community that suffers, understand this larger community of suffering. There you have that scalar connection again. And I think subversive arches do demonstrate that kind of capacity. The Zonyani, the people of Zonyana, similarly, because of their clan structure, which is a classic segmentary structure. At first, I thought I was actually reliving a European version of that famous work by Evans Pritchard, The Newer, you know, where he talks about segmentary clans. And in some ways, their social structure is very similar. That structure allows them also to leap from level to level in a scalar view. That probably partly explains why they often evince a kind of not just tolerance, but acceptance of people who are very different from themselves. It doesn't mean that there are no people there who are biased or that they don't have some forms of bias. I think you'll find plenty in both communities. But as communities, they do seem to express a kind of openness to otherness that would not be true, for instance, of some of the far-right groups that we see now beginning to gain in visibility and especially audibility here in the U.S. or in Europe, and which are a source of great anxiety to me and should be to all of us. These are places where people talk to each other and resolve their problems without the help of the state as far as possible. And I think that's something also that the state finds hard to tolerate. And while they say, you know, we're very proud of being Thai in the one case, Greek in the other, what they're saying is we do Thai-ness and Greekness much better than the governments. Let's not forget that Thailand was once known as Siam, and Siam was actually a multi-ethnic polity. Again, it was a nation state from the early, but technically, I suppose we could say it became a nation state with the arrival of the present dynasty in 1782. But it really only started to look like a standard European type Western state in the middle of the 19th century. And that process, I think, then led to a gradual emphasis, which then accelerated and has been very intense in recent years, on Thai-ness. Now, what's interesting is that in Greece, things have gone a little bit the other way in recent years. Greece was notorious for being extremely nationalistic. You probably remember the Macedonian conflict. And there are certainly people who take very strong positions in Greece on this. But it is a place where now you're not going to get attacked. At the worst, you'll get attacked verbally and sometimes in quite intelligent ways if you dare to say that the connection with ancient Greek culture isn't the whole story about modern Greek identity. You know, I was made an honorary citizen of Greece last year, and this is a very conservative government. I cannot help but think that it is a sign of a real change in the country that somebody like me with, you know, what I'm sure some people see as subversively archaistic tendencies, could be honored in this way, and I found it very moving. I should tell you that Zonyana made me an honorary citizen of the village 3 weeks later, so I have the state and the anti-state somehow with me, and they like that idea. But, you know, jokes apart, it is, I think, really interesting that these two communities and some of the others I talk about in the book don't really seem to make a big issue of rejecting outsiders. But it is also true that this kind of formation could morph into a fascist kind of ethno-nationalism that seeks to force the state to expel everyone who doesn't belong. Is that subversive archaism? Well, in the sense that they want to work against the bureaucrats, I suppose it is. And they find themselves often in opposition to the bureaucrats because the bureaucrats at least are paying lip service to the idea of being more inclusive. So these are cases that have to be examined individually, one by one. Anthropology is fundamentally an empirical discipline. It generates theory that does not seek to produce broad generalizations and testable hypotheses in the same way that, say, econometrics does. I would say that theory in anthropology is much more like historiography or literary theory. That doesn't make it any less important, but it makes it much more aligned with issues of interpretation. And it also allows us then to point out that some of the larger principles that are laid out by our colleagues in other social sciences don't recognize the importance of exceptions. So I could see the notion, I see the notion of subversive archaism, at least I so intended, to be a contribution to the discussion and critique of concepts like resistance. I also see it as something that might help us to understand these extreme far-right enclaves and their reactions to the state. Certainly, if we talk about the branch Davidians, we might be dealing with something that is certainly on the edge of that kind of situation. You know, it's interesting that the major anthropological work of that was done by James Phobian, who also did important research in Greece. Maybe there are certain places that are more conducive to this kind of analysis. But in any case, the model is useful not because it is predictive, but because it's heuristic. And I think that's also true of the concept of crypto-colonialism. I got into a lot of trouble in Greece with one philosopher who had been described to me as a representative of the extreme center. They talk about, you know, the relics of the old liberal order who's now desperately hanging on to a very conservative agenda, who said that I was putting forward a theory that would fail the Popperian test of falsifiability. And in fact, I don't think it does fail that test. But what it does is it allows us to see that maybe there is more of a range of options. So it has heuristic value in pushing us to ask about every community that seems to be in difficulty with the state and is using the notion of heritage to fight back. Is this in fact a strategy? Is it invoking some earlier notion or some local notion of heritage? And is what it's evoking actually the sort of half-repressed presence that I am calling spectrality?
Wow, that's so fascinating. And also congratulations on the honorary citizenship. I don't even know what that means. So what does it entail? Like, are you, you know, like, are you a citizen now, like, or what?
Well, it's always interesting to think about where a concept like this might take us as the world around us changes. And the other thing that I do think is important is that there are a lot of pressures now against anthropological research, one of which is that current ethics procedures, which frankly have very little to do with ethics and a great deal to do with liability issues for universities, a lot of these ethics procedures make it very difficult to do ethnography. And I would argue that they are therefore restrictions of academic freedom. There obviously has to be, must be, some degree of ethical oversight in any discipline. That goes without saying. But the current form seems to me to have much more to do with protecting the interests of institutions. And in that sense, I suppose I'm an institutional subversive archaist. I believe that, we should challenge the accepted bureaucratic wisdom of our institutions to determine what is, in fact, an ethical way to do fieldwork. I do know this, that when I went to Zonyana, I was told in those days that I went there originally to do research on kinship. I was there for 4 months without discovering that people were raiding each other's flocks between villages and doing it reciprocally and quite systematically. It was only a couple of days before I left after that first tour of 4 months of fieldwork that in a conversation with the village secretary, I discovered that, yes, this was going on quite regularly, and that the people I had spotted and had asked him about were probably kin to the victims of a recent sheep theft who'd come to find their ritual kin, probably people where they were connected through baptism or marriage, in Zonyana to try to sort things out. So to cut a long story short, I came back the next year and did about a month of additional field work to determine whether this was something I could inquire into. Having shown that I knew some of this vocabulary and having also begun to master the local dialect, I managed to get people to talk about it and even to let me record their stories. And I ended up with something like, 200 stories about animal theft and revenge and all of the things that are associated with that, including the ritual practices and a very interesting form of ritual reconciliation. Well, there were people in the village who said, don't talk about this. And, you know, if I were dealing with a present day IRB or something of that kind, I would, the ethics control, I would have a difficult time persuading them that if the villagers told me not to talk about it, I still wanted to do so. A, I think it's condescending to act as if your informants can't look after their own interests and can't argue back to you. So you should be prepared to discuss it with them as equals. And that also means sometimes arguing with them. B, some of what they were saying was the rhetoric of defending the state, but not necessarily their own interests. The book came out in 1985 in English. It was then translated into Greek in 2012. And my wife and I took copies of the book to the village early in 2013, only to discover that many of the villagers knew the book, had bought it, had already read it, and were delighted with it. And what that said to me was, what they've realized from reading the book is that the big difference between journalists and myself was that journalists usually would write about these things in a sensational way. I was treating animal theft as a social institution that was the basis on which shepherds were able to create alliances in what is physically very difficult country. And they saw that immediately, and in a way they were very appreciative of it, and certainly I did not hear a single complaint. So, of course, they know me very well. They know that by learning the language, the local language, I've shown that kind of respect as well. It made it possible for me to do my work. There was real reciprocity in that sense. And I continue to have a very close affective relationship with the village. Now, people outside the village have an extraordinary view of it. And I talk about it a bit in the book, that, for example, people will say, you're going to Zonyana, but they'll cut your throat, or words to that effect. One American friend was about to come up to the village with his family, and his local interlocutor said, but your colleague doesn't spend the night there, does he? So there's all of this mythologizing of these wild people who turn out actually to be rather formal. The majority of the villagers disapproved of the violence that led to the death of a policeman in 2007, and certainly inflated the notoriety of the village beyond anything anyone could have imagined. The villagers, nonetheless, are also aware that they can play up that image when it suits them, when it's useful. After all, they might as well get something out of a set of ideas that has otherwise cost them rather a lot. So they are living always in communication with the outside world. this is not an isolated community. I'm not sure there are any isolated communities in the world anyway. They're talking to each other and to people like me, and I become then part of that dialogue. And I think that by writing a book like this, I hope anyway, that I can show my readers that even though the idea of comparing an urban enclave in Thailand with a mountain village on the island of Crete might seem utterly lunatic, actually, the fact that one can show that there are really impressive similarities in the way that they deal with the nation state gives us a new understanding, not just of the local communities, but of the nature of the nation state itself, and also of the possibility of alternative polities. So, it's funny. When I started to write the book, I still had a lot of doubts. As I wrote it, it all began to fall into place. And one of the nice things about the act of writing is that very often your subconscious starts to kick in, and all the things that you vaguely sensed suddenly come into focus. And that certainly was my experience with this book.
Yes, thank you so much. So how do you suggest or advise that researchers or scholars should engage with this book?
Well, I think that, first of all, ethnography should be enjoyable to read. I hope this book is enjoyable. I enjoy the act of writing. I hope use too much jargon. Obviously, there is a theoretical dimension. I think over the years, my writing has loosened up a lot. I'm a careful writer in the sense that I use words precisely, and I'm pretty fussy about syntax and so on. But at the same time, an anthropological book, and especially an ethnography, this book is in a way a double ethnography, should also be a work of art. I would argue, in fact, that ethnographic writing or ethnography as a practice is one of the few things that allows you to be a scientist and an artist at the same time. So that might be a very good framework in which to approach the book.
Great. Thank you so much. It's been so wonderful to talk to you about the book. I had such a great time reading it. I really appreciate your time. This is Ikrash Gupta-Chima, your host for the New Books Network. Thank you so much for joining us today.